From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. We're going to hear now about one of the federal government's most aggressive efforts to police corporate crime. It comes from a post-Watergate law called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Prosecutors have used the law to get more than $1 billion in bribery fines from huge companies, including Siemens and Daimler Chrysler. But now the Chamber of Commerce is pushing back. As NPR's Carrie Johnson reports, the chamber has hired former Justice Department leaders to make the case that the law is out of date.
The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, or FCPA, dates back to the 1970s, a time when executives carried briefcases stuffed with cash to win lucrative contracts from foreign governments. The FCPA was supposed to put an end to all that by making it a crime for U.S. companies to offer money to employees of foreign governments to secure a business advantage. More than 30 years later, the law's open for debate all over again. Former Attorney General Michael Mukasey says the law needs to be narrowed because being charged with a crime has huge consequences for business.
The person who did it, yes, but not the company, which is in effect the death knell for the company and for a whole lot of employees and stockholders who didn't do anything wrong.
Mukasey is working with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to convince members of Congress to overhaul the foreign bribery law. And he's attracted support from both Democratic and Republican lawmakers, who say they want to introduce a bipartisan update later this year. Why now? Well, for decades, the Justice Department took the FCPA out of its toolbox every once in a while. But over the last few years, foreign bribery investigations have made up a more important and high-profile part of prosecutors' caseloads. Lanny Brewer runs the criminal division at the Justice Department.
American companies and foreign companies should be competing based on the quality of their goods, the quality of their services, and not because they're committing crimes.
The law applies to both U.S. companies and foreign businesses that have operations in this country. Brewer says that levels the playing field. But executives at the Chamber of Commerce say the law is producing a lot of confusion and big legal bills. They're urging Congress to amend the law in a handful of ways. That includes a provision to cut back on legal liability for companies that acquire other businesses with foreign bribery troubles, and another controversial provision making clear that companies that require employees to behave on the up and up can use those compliance programs as a defense to fight possible criminal charges. Harold Kim is a senior vice president at the chamber.
Providing more clarity as to what the law means is really the aim and purpose of this, while ensuring that the enforcement agencies can still go after the bad guys.
The U.S. Chamber is being disingenuous.
That's Sarah Prey. She follows Africa policy for the Open Society Foundations, an advocacy group that gives grants to organizations that promote democracy. The foundations give money to NPR.
Because what would result would be a gutting of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and would all but eviscerate the Department of Justice's ability to adequately enforce the law.
As for claims justice is too aggressive, Prey says, there aren't that many cases, and 8 of the 10 biggest settlements have come in cases against foreign companies, not American businesses. Mukasey, the former attorney general and retired federal judge, says that misses the point.
I don't think it's so much a matter of the number of actual enforcement actions as it is the effect of possible enforcement actions on people's behavior.
He says companies are spending millions of dollars in legal fees to investigate foreign bribery allegations, even though they may amount to small potatoes issues, such as gifts on a business contact's birthday. David Kennedy is a law professor at Harvard University. He studied the law for the Open Society Foundations. He says lawmakers back in the 70s had something very clear in mind.
The goal of Congress was precisely to avoid the situation where U.S. corporations undermined the stability and credibility of governments abroad.
Kennedy and other supporters of the bribery law say the United Kingdom, Germany, and other European allies are all stepping up their enforcement. And now, they say, is no time for the U.S. to step back. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Las Vegas hosted last night's Republican presidential debate. For Nevadans, it was an opportunity to hear what candidates can offer to address their state's economic problems. David Damore teaches politics at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and he told us about some of the key issues on voters' minds.
Well, obviously, you have highest foreclosure rate in the country, highest bankruptcy rate in the country, highest unemployment rate in the country. And then last week, we got a new one, which is the biggest drop in median income.
That's terrible. I mean, those four things, each of them individually, are huge.
Absolutely. And sadly for us, it's been going on now for quite some time. So we've been sort of been bumping around the bottom for the last 2 or 3 years here. You know, you hear among the Republican candidates about lower taxes and less regulation. Well, we already have that in Nevada, but somehow it's not solving our unemployment woes. And I think there is this notion that what we had 4 or 5 years ago is not coming back, right? We're continuous development, continuous building, but there is no plan B here.
Low regulation and low taxes are such a key Republican touchstone at this moment. And you say Nevada has had very low regulation and low taxes for a long time, and yet it leads the country in foreclosures, in personal bankruptcies, in unemployment. What does that mean for the Republican argument in the state?
That's a great question. You know, I think it shows that economic diversity and economic growth is a little more complicated than just those sort of mantras. One of the things we always hear as we go out there and we try to attract new businesses is businesses don't want to come here because they don't think that they can hire the people who are going to be educated enough to do the more demanding jobs that we're trying to attract here. So it's a mix, and we've been lucky for our history as be able to rely primarily on mining and gaming, and then obviously development in the last 20 years. So there's never been this push to diversify. And now that they're trying to do this, they're finding, yeah, businesses do care about low taxes and low regulation, but they also care about workforce training. They care about the quality of life. If they want to tell their employees they're going to move to Nevada here, are these people going to want to do that? And that's the harder sell for us. So, I mean, I know it resonates well among the Republican primary voters, you know, low taxes, low regulation. But if that was the case, we'd have zero unemployment in this state.
What about the immigration issue? In neighboring Arizona, a very tough immigration law has gotten a lot of attention. Nevada has a large Latino population. How is that playing out in the state's politics?
It's made the Democrats' job a lot easier for outreach and organization and mobilization because they can point not only to Arizona but also some of the laws coming out of Utah as well to simply say, you know, this is the Republican Party. Look, it's what they're offering you. Now, to his credit, Governor Sandoval, our Republican governor, has taken a much, much more moderate tone on that, and it hasn't cost him politically here. He obviously has a lot of the business community in that camp as well here.
Trivia fact about Nevada that I found very surprising is that it's the most urbanized state in the country. Tell me what that means and what the implications of it could be.
You know, like a lot of the states in the Mountain West, these huge geographic areas that traditionally were dominated by rural interests, well, in the last 20 years, that's very much changed. So if you look at the sort of political geography of Nevada, you have 87-86% of the entire state's population reside in two counties. And that's why we're one of the most urban states in the country here. And
so you're saying 87% of the people either live in the Las Vegas area or
Las Vegas
in the Reno area.
Or in the Reno, yeah, Washoe County or Clark County. And so in the, you know, big land mass of Nevada is only 12-13% of the entire population. So what that means, of course, is advantage Democrats, right? The sort of notion is that as states get more diverse and more dense, you get constituencies that are more friendly to the Democratic Party. And that certainly has been the case in Nevada over the last 10 years. And the Republicans, this is where they're playing catch up, not just here, but across the region, is how can they get a message to resonate with these growing demographics that are working against their sort of traditional older white rural base here. And from a political organization standpoint, it's much, much easier for the Democrats. They can invest in these urban counties, and you know, those are going to determine the statewide outcomes.
That's Professor David Damore, a political scientist at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Unions are shutting down Greece today in what a prominent Greek newspaper calls the mother of all strikes. Flights are grounded, state offices are shuttered, and shops are closed in the biggest organized protest against austerity measures since the debt crisis began almost 2 years ago. This week, Parliament is expected to pass the latest package of cuts, but the protests show that the country's big unions will continue to resist. Joanna Kakissis has the story from Athens.
Even before the call for today's big strikes, demonstrations had already begun. Since last week, these protesters have occupied the finance ministry, waving Greek flags from office balconies and blasting songs of resistance. On the street below, dozens of public sector workers march to parliament. "Don't bow your head," they chanted. "The only road is resistance." Many Greeks oppose the latest austerity measures, which include more job and wage cuts in the public sector, as well as a controversial new property tax. But unions have been especially incensed by a provision curtailing collective bargaining rights in the private sector. And they have found a supporter in former Labor Minister Luca Cazzelli. She said the provision could threaten the national minimum wage and the working class. "If the economy falls into a deeper recession, state revenues will fall dramatically," she told Mega, a Greek TV station. "It's our responsibility to point this out to international lenders." The government is trying to negotiate with unions and Katseli, who's still in parliament. She's threatened to veto the provision. Platon Tinios, an economics professor at the University of Piraeus, says unions have long held sway over political parties. He says restricting the influence of unions will help open up the economy at this crucial time.
"They certainly haven't done very much to promote economic growth or competitiveness. They haven't done very much to get us out of the problem, and you can point to quite a lot of things they've done to get us into the problem."
Tinio says unions long prevented reforms now seen as inevitable. Changes to the bloated pension system, for example, or privatization of state assets. Now Greece is bankrupt and has no choice but to change, he says.
"Power is a function of how much leeway you have to influence matters. And Greece at the moment, we have very little leeway to influence anything at all. So one wonders what are the objective of the unions are."
A small group of elderly protesters belonging to a communist party union are walking along a busy street in suburban Athens. A man is speaking into a megaphone. "The powers that be are trying to make us into 21st century slaves," he says. Vasilis Langadas, who's 30, watches the group march by. He's not a fan of unions, which he says are corrupt, but he supports collective bargaining because he believes it protects workers. He works at an international mobile phone company and has seen many of his colleagues laid off.
"Tomorrow, maybe I don't have a job. I don't know if I'm going to lose my inner self or something. I'm going to get crazy and jump from the window." No, of course not. But things are difficult. Things are difficult.
He says the protests this week are not just about the power of unions. Austerity is killing the future, he says, and someone has to speak up. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
NPR's Sylvia Pagioli is in Athens, and she joins us on the line for a look at what the strike is looking like there. Good morning, Sylvia.
Good morning, Renee.
What's the scene there? Pretty quiet, I imagine.
It's very quiet. There are no buses, taxis, all flights have been canceled, state offices, shops, even bakeries are shut down. This mother of all strikes is the first 48-hour general strike in, I think, two decades. And it follows weeks of walkouts in many sectors, from judges to journalists, school teachers to garbage collectors. There are piles of garbage everywhere in Athens. The walkout started about 2 weeks ago. And to give you a sense of the anger and how fed up Greeks are with the austerity measures, a garbage strike of this scope some years ago would have triggered fury at the strikers. Today, even though the health ministry has warned of the dangers for public health, there's a very strong sense of solidarity with the garbage collectors.
But as we just heard, Sylvia, tomorrow the Greek parliament will vote on this new austerity package. It includes more wage and job cuts, higher taxes, and a watering down of national collective bargaining in the private sector. Is there any chance that this new austerity package will not pass?
Well, some lawmakers of the ruling socialists are reportedly wavering. Last night, Prime Minister George Papandreou made a final appeal to them. He also met with the leader of the conservative opposition. But Antonis Samaras said, "No way, we're not going to vote for these measures because they are undermining economic growth." The ruling socialists are way down in the polls. Government officials are increasingly isolated from society. Civil servants have taken over several government buildings. Even the finance minister, Evangelos Venizelos, has been unable to get into his office for the last 2 weeks. And leaflets pasted to the wall of the building say, "The massacre of our wages will be the nightmare of bankers." And yet most analysts believe the measures will pass. The problem will be implementing them.
And all of this, of course, is about Greece not defaulting on its massive debt. European leaders will be meeting next weekend again to try and resolve the crisis. Can they really solve it?
Well, that's the big question being asked in financial markets. This will be the EU leaders' sixth attempt this year to come up with what they keep calling a comprehensive solution. They're expected to announce whether Greece will get the next installment of the $150 billion bailout that was agreed to last year. They're supposed to talk about recapitalization of some major European banks and whether the new rescue fund that they have finally cobbled together will be increased to as much as $2 trillion. But all the leaders do up to now is send mixed signals. At one moment, it appears France and Germany are on the verge of agreement. Then German Chancellor Angela Merkel says, "Do not expect a miracle cure." Then we hear French President Nicolas Sarkozy warning ominously, "Those who destroy Europe and the euro will bear responsibility for resurgence of conflict and divisions on our continent." That's pretty heavy stuff, and yet nothing concrete is coming out.
And in the middle of all of that back and forth, the Greek crisis is becoming contagious.
That's the nightmare in European capitals. Yesterday, the rating agency Moody's warned of a possible downgrade of France's credit rating. And after that, Moody cut Spain's credit rating by two notches. The other big rating agency, Standard & Poor's, cut the ratings of 24 Italian banks and financial institutions, citing weaker growth prospects and tighter credit conditions. Moody's assessment was very gloomy. It said no credible solution of the sovereign debt crisis has emerged, and it will take time to fully restore confidence in the eurozone's political cohesion and growth prospects. With rumors flying and credit ratings downgraded, the atmosphere is feverish. The debt crisis seems to be spreading. There's a sense of greater urgency, and yet European leaders continue to dither.
Sylvia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Renee.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli speaking to us from Athens.